Chazal tell us, the Gemara tells us that there's a concept of being Misabel al Yerushalayim. Call him Misabel al Yerushalayim. Anyone who has or mourns for Yerushalayim, Zoche Veroa, will have the privilege to see it being rebuilt. And we associate Avelus, therefore, with the absence of Yerushalayim. And we mourn, and the specific day on which we mourn, of course, is Tisha B'Av. In fact, some of the practices of Tisha B'Av itself are parallel to practices a mourner observes. The Gemara makes that equation. The Gemara says that some of the restrictions of Tisha B'Av are the same restrictions that Rachmana Litzlan, a person who is in Avelus, was mourning one of the seven immediate relatives, has to observe during the week of Shiva. For example, we don't bathe, we don't rub certain types of oils and so on ourselves. We also don't go to work on Tisha B'Av unless we absolutely have to, and Avel also doesn't do Malacha. And there are many others that sort of parallel between what an Avel is allowed to do. In fact, there were halachic discussions, which are not for now, is exactly how far the parallel goes. Because in a different Gemara, the Gemara equates Tisha B'Av in terms of its restriction with Yom Kippur. So is it parallel to Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur is not a day of Avelus. Is it parallel to Yom Kippur? Is it parallel to Avelus? But in any event, there are certain things, certainly, which relate to Avelus. Anyone who has had the experience of sitting Shiva, God forbid, after the loss of a relative, I know I had the experience myself, and just about many, many people have told me that when they're observing Shiva, when they're observing Avelus, aside from whatever the restrictions they are, they find out a lot about that person that they didn't even know. It could be someone they were very close to. It could be a parent or a spouse you're very close to. And you hear things, wow, I never knew that. You loved the person, you were close to the person, but no person knows everything that everyone does, especially what they may do for somebody else. And during the week of Shiva, I think it's a very common experience to suddenly hear things that you didn't realize, you didn't know about. You learn a little bit more about that person. And perhaps that's an auxiliary purpose of the entire concept of Shiva, is that people can get together and people can share with the family stories and about the history of the individual that paint a certain picture of that individual and enhance your appreciation of him or of her. Perhaps you can suggest that the same is true of the Avelus of Tisha B'Av. The Avelus of Tisha B'Av, we mourn Yerushalayim, call Misabel Yerushalayim, but perhaps we don't often think about exactly what Yerushalayim is. That's part of the idea of the kinnis this morning, especially the last group of kinnis, the so-called Tzion kinnos. But I thought it would be appropriate today in this vein, instead of focusing on one particular event in Jewish history, as we've done in past years, to take a look at the history of Yerushalayim. Just to be Misabel Yerushalayim by learning about Yerushalayim. Not saying anything new here that probably people have come across at one time or another, but sometimes it's good to look at things as one, you know, one big picture, and then come away with what Yerushalayim is, what Yerushalayim has gone through, what it was in the early days of Jewish history, what it is in modern day Jewish history. The Gemara tells us in Kiddushin that Yerushalayim is known for its beauty. The Gemara says that 10 measures of beauty came down from the heavens to the earth. 9 of them were taken by Yerushalayim and the rest was split with the rest of the world. This may have been a biased remark by whoever it is that made it in the Gemara. Nonetheless, Yerushalayim to us is a place of beauty. And as we'll see, it was viewed as such, at least at certain times in Jewish history, even independent of the Beis HaMikdash, independent of the Jewish people there. Now, according to the entry in Wikipedia, and I don't vouch for everything in Wikipedia, I don't even vouch for this necessarily, but even if this isn't exactly right, it gives a certain picture. It says as follows: during its long history, Jerusalem has been attacked 52 times, captured and recaptured 44 times, besieged 23 times, and destroyed twice. So again, even if those numbers are not exactly right, that's quite a statement. There's no other place that can make that kind of a statement. And that's what I really want to go through today. The earliest mention of Jerusalem in secular sources is a Middle Kingdom Egyptian text where they refer to a city called Rusalimum, which is understood to be Jerusalem. I don't know if that's the Arab pronunciation or not, but that's the Egyptian text in the year 2000 BCE. According to our Tanakh, there was a city called Shalem. Yerushalayim is not mentioned in the Torah. Shamayim is not mentioned once, not even once in the Torah. There's reasons behind that. The Rambam and the Maruchim discusses why that would be. One is that if the people realized, if the non-Jews realized how important Yerushalayim was to the Jews, they would hold the Jews up even more, and they would start more wars over Yerushalayim, and so on. Different suggestions. The Rambam has three different suggestions as to why Yerushalayim is not mentioned. Yerushalayim is not mentioned in the Torah. In fact, the Torah almost seems to go out of its way to avoid mentioning Yerushalayim. It simply refers to the city, HaMokom HaShivcha Hashem, the place that Hashem will choose. But of course, in Tanakh, in Nevi'im, and Ksuvim, it's mentioned many, many, many times. I forgot already exactly how many times. You can check in the concordance. There are many, many references to Yerushalayim directly. But it's interesting, Yerushalayim, the overwhelming majority of the amount of times that it's mentioned in Tanakh, is spelled without that second yud. Yud, Reish, Vav, Shin, Lamed, Mem. There's no second yud. In fact, in more recent times, not to go into the halachas on Tisha B'Av, in recent times, there's discussion among poskim is how to spell Yerushalayim in a get. You give a get, so you have to, a divorce bill, a get has to have this exact spelling and so on. So all kinds of literature in different areas about spelling cities, how do you spell this town, how do you spell that town. The question even in America today, how do you spell certain towns, whatever. But Yerushalayim, you know, you think, because most of the time in Tanakh, Yerushalayim is without the yud. And that last phrase, Shin Lamed Mem, there is a city called Shalem, Shin Lamed Mem, which is mentioned in the Torah. To refresh your memory, for those who may not recall, the Torah tells us that after the battle between the four kings and the five kings, in which Lot, the nephew of Avram, was taken prisoner of war, Avram jumped into the battle, rescued his nephew Lot, and restored and was victorious in his mission, and not only brought Lot back, but brought back the other people in that area of Sodom and Amorah, and in that section. And the Torah tells us that there was a gentleman by the name of Malki Tzedek. Malki Tzedek, Melech Shalem. Malki Tzedek, the king of Shalem. Hotzi Lech Vayayin. He greeted Avraham Avinu with bread, with wine, with food, and he blessed him, and so on. That's in the Torah in Parshas Lech Lecha. Shalem, in English, Salem. What exactly is Shalem? So, by our tradition, Shalem is Yerushalayim. And hence, Yerushalayim is spelled without that yud. It's sort of like a contracted word, Yerushalayim, which includes the name of the original town, the original city that was there, Shin Lamed Mem, Shalem, is included. Now, Chazal tell us that this Malki Tzedek was identified, and by the way, that appendage to the name Tzedek was also known later. Yerushalayim, for example, is mentioned in the book of Yehoshua, and there the king is called Adoni Tzedek, you know, so that nickname or that suffix to the name is associated with kings of Yerushalayim. We have many times that certain kings have, you know, the same names or the similar names. You know, a lot of the French kings were called Louis and so on. So, you know, a lot of British kings are called John or called Henry and so on. So anyway, so certain names were associated with royal families in certain areas. So this was perhaps another indication. This Malki Tzedek was the king of Shalem. That was Yerushalayim, because Adoni Tzedek, perhaps a descendant of his, or perhaps not. Perhaps someone simply took that name because he was the king. Was the king of Yerushalayim. Chazal tell us that Malki Tzedek is identified with Shem ben Noach. Remember, Noach had three sons, Shem, Cham, and Yefes, right? So Shem ben Noach, because it says about Malki Tzedek, he was a Kohen, whatever exactly that means at that time, and so he was identified by Chazal with Shem ben Noach. Okay, so Shem had the city called Shalem. He was still alive. You do the math, he was still alive at the time of Avraham Avinu. Okay, people lived a long time in those days. Now, the next important event that we have relating to Yerushalayim, although it doesn't say specifically, is in the very next sedra, that was Lech Lecha, and Vayera, we have Akedas Yitzchak. Akedas Yitzchak, we know, takes place on a mountaintop. We know that when Avram was walking with his servants, with Yitzchak, he saw the place, Merchok, he saw it was a mountain, and so on. So he's supposed to go to this mountain, doesn't say exactly what that mountain is, but after the Akedah, he gives the mountain a name. Vayikra Avram Shem Akum Hashem Yireh. Okay, again, that's it's the end of Parshas Vayera. It's the laning on Rosh Hashanah the second day. It says Hashem Yireh. He called the place Hashem Yireh. Yireh, knows the word Yireh. Asher Yameh Hayom Behar Hashem Yireh. Okay, that you'll be seen in the house of the mountain of Hashem. Behar Hashem Yireh, you'll be seen. So the Medrash tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to contemplate what to name this place. On the one hand, he was going to name it Shalem, so that's an affront to Avram, who called it Yireh, some form of the word Yireh. On the other hand, if you call it Yireh, so that's an affront to Shem, who called it Shalem. Therefore, the Medrash in Bereishis Rabba says that he combined it, and he called it Yerushalayim, right, which has forms of both words. So Yerushalayim was built on compromise. It's an interesting idea. But in any event, it compromised by bringing together the Yeru, the Yeret, that from Avram's nickname, Yeret, and the Shalem of Shem Ben Och. In any event, but that's the first reference to Yerushalayim, as Chazal understands it. But in terms of conquering the city as a city called Yerushalayim in the days of Yerushalayim, again, Yerushalayim is not mentioned in the Chumash. So as far as Yerushalayim is concerned in the Tanakh, so we find that it was occupied by a group of people called the Yavusi. Okay, the Yavusi is one of the seven nations. Kani, Chiti, Amara, Prizva, Geshva, Yavusi, and son. The Yavusi is one of the seven nations. And they were what we would identify today, I guess, as a Canaanite tribe, right? I mean, the Kanani was kind of the nickname for all those people, even though they weren't all Kanani. Kanani, Chiti, Amara, Prizva, different nations. So one of them is Yavusi. And the Tanakh describes Yavusi as living, look and say for Yahushua, and look in the second book of Shmuel, you'll see that the Yavusim lived on a hill by Yerushalayim, and there is a gentleman is identified there as Adoni Tzedek, who was perhaps the king of the Yavusi, or king of the people in that area. They banded against Yahushua. Pesukim tell us when Yahushua was conquering the land, they were defeated by Yahushua. However, the Pasuk tells us in the chapter 15, Perek Tesvav, Yahushua, that the Yahushua was not able to fully get rid of the Yavusim from Yerushalayim. Okay, and the Pasuk therefore says that Ara Yomazeh, at least at that time, there was still Yavusim living in Yerushalayim, maintaining some sort of control over what was known as Yerushalayim. Okay? Yerushalayim, as you know, or as you don't know, perhaps I'll mention now, it's kind of the border, it's the northern part of Yehuda, and then the southern part of Binyamin, the shape that when Eretz Yisrael was parceled up. Okay, so Yavusim still had control, and years later, years after Yahushua, by the time of David HaMelech, the Yavusim were still in control of the area of Yerushalayim. David HaMelech wanted the city very much, but the Yavusim had a strong fortress, and they made reference to the fact that they had such a strong fortress that even the Ivrim and the Pisrim can defend it. Ivrim, Iver, is a blind person. Pisach, related to the Pesach, I'm jumping over. Pesach is the lame, person who's lame. So the Ivrim and the Pisrim, the blind and the lame. In other words, we're so confident of our ability to hold on to the city that even the blind and lame, we can put up blind and lame soldiers, they'll still be able to defend you against it. Okay? Now, according to the Tanakh, David HaMelech was able to execute a surprise attack. Okay, according to tradition, through the war, you know, Yerushalayim, to this day, anybody who's been to Yerushalayim, you know, if you've gone on any tour of Yerushalayim, probably any tour of Eretz Yisrael, but certainly Yerushalayim, you hear all about the water issue and how to have water. You know, again, there's no, you know, it's difficult to get water in Yerushalayim, so they have the spring, and you can go today to the tunnels, and these are historical places, but, you know, we visit them today, and, I mean, every time you go to Eretz Yisrael, every time you read something about it, they've uncovered yet another section in the you know, sort of like what's now called Ir David, that area. Again, if you haven't been there, you should go. I mean, I try and go every trip because it's different every time because they're constantly excavating, they're constantly finding new things. Very, very fascinating. But in any event, so there, according to tradition, there's a place there called Warren's Shaft. For those who may remember from tours you've taken, Warren's Shaft, you know, that's not from the Yavusi time, that's from our archaeologists. But in any event, there was some question about exactly how they attacked, but somehow they were able to execute a sneak attack. Yoav was the general of David. So Yoav, David said, whoever conquers, whoever going to go in will be elevated in status and so on. So Yoav was the one who engineered this conquest of Yerushalayim. As far as the Ivrim and Pisrim, so what exactly does that mean, the Ivrim and Pisrim? So Chazal, I'm just sharing with you, have an interesting explanation for it. The Ivrim and the Pisrim were protected. Now, probably they were idols of some sort that the Yavusim had. One of a lame person, one of a blind person, exactly why they had that, one can speculate, but that was their idols in whom they trusted, and they felt that you know, that's going to defend the city. But Chazal have that when Avram Avinu and Yitzhak made a deal with Avimelech, the king of the Plishtim, okay, so it says, and I go, we also read this on Rosh Hashanah, Tishkor li ulinini lechdi, right, a covenant that my descendants are going to start up with your descendants. Somehow the Yavusim are understood to be descendants from the Plishtim, or connected somehow to the Plishtim. So it wasn't that the Yavusi, I'm sorry, the Ivrim and the Pisrim, the blind and the lame, were defending them, but rather they knew that the Jewish people were not able to conquer the land because of a covenant made years earlier with Abimelech. And some say the Iver and the Piseach, that's a reference to Avram's child and grand. Iver, Yitzhak was blind, or in his old age, Yitzhak couldn't see, so the Iver is a reference to the blind. And the Piseach, as we know, Yaakov walked with a limp, right, after the wrestling battle with the Amalek, Yaakov walked with a limp. So the Iver and the Piseach, right, the blind and the lame that defended the city, was the covenant, so to speak, made by Avraham Avinu, through his descendants, Yitzchok and Yaakov and so on, to prevent the Jews from attacking. Why were they allowed to attack? Well, because you look carefully at the Psukim, it was not a permanent covenant, it was only in the Neil and that day, X number of generations, so now it was over. In any event, this is approximately 1000 BCE, when David HaMelech takes over Yerushalayim, and he sets up what's called Ir David, and that becomes his capital city. Note that the Beis HaMikdash is not yet built. And this is not for now, but it's not automatic. It was not automatic that the Beis HaMikdash had to be in the same place where the capital, the political capital, was. David HaMelech set up Yerushalayim as his political capital. One of the kinos that we said a short while ago make mention of a discussion in the Gemara, that they weren't so sure where to build the Beis HaMikdash initially. Okay, there's a place called Ein Etam. We know where that is today. Ein Etam near Yerushalayim, which is a slightly higher mountain than the mountain where we call the Temple Mount today. And it was a halamina to build the Beis HaMikdash over there. And then they darshan the Pasuk regarding the Beis HaMikdash, prophetic Pasuk, by the Brach of Binyamin. On Simchas Torah it says, Uvein Kseifav Shachem. Kadosh Baruch Hu's presence, the Shekhinah will rest, Bein Kseifav, on the shoulder. From that, they darshan being safe of Shachain, so it's not the head, which is the highest part of the body, but the shoulder, which is the next highest. They recognize it's not going to be Ein Etam. It's one of the kinnis mentioned they came to Shalom, not Ein Etam. Anyway, so I just mentioned again, David HaMelech established this as his capital prior to the building of the Beis HaMikdash, which of course we know was not built until the days of his son, Shlomo HaMelech. So David HaMelech, but he did establish Yerushalayim as his capital, again, perhaps through this sneak attack through the Gihon Spring, whatever it may be, they overcame the Yebusim. There was a gentleman there by the name of Aravna, who may have been a Yebusi king, who also owned something there. He was some sort of a king at the time of David HaMelech, perhaps even slightly before, and he gave something to David HaMelech. David HaMelech built a Mizbeach, by the Goren, by the threshing floor, Goren, Arnon, okay, Aravna, more technically, mentioned Hoshanas. In any event, that's how the Yerushalayim became the capital of the king of the city, or the kingdom of David HaMelech. And again, it was not the Yerushalayim of today, but rather what today called Ir David. Again, many of you have been there, but for those who have not, so if you go outside what's called Shar Ashpo is the Dung Gate, which is right the closest gate to the Kosel Maravi. So down there, where they have all the buses, okay, so down there, the slope that goes down, that's Ir David. Okay, so Ir David was not like, you know, if you walk into the old, what's today called the old city, by Shar Yafo, okay, by the Jaffa Gate, or even by Shar Tzion, okay, that was not part of the original city of Yerushalayim, certainly not on the other side, that's what they call, you know, the Arab, the Shar Shechem, the Damascus Gate, and so on. David HaMelech, you know, it was the slope, the Ir David, and again, they're constantly discovering new evidence of a Jewish kingdom there, and so on and so forth. But that was the Ir David that he established as the capital. And as you know, Shlomo HaMelech subsequently built the Beis HaMikdash, the first Beis HaMikdash, built again on the top of that slope. So if you can, again, if you picture it, you think where the Beis HaMikdash is, where the Kosel Maravi is today, okay, a remnant of the Beis HaMikdash, and then go down. If you're standing, let's say, by the Kosel Maravi, it'll be to your right. If you're facing the Western Wall, so to your right, going down, the topography begins to slope, and that's where the city of David was, and that's where the city of Shlomo was, and the Beis HaMikdash at the top. That's the background in terms of that. Now, as you know, after the death of Shlomo HaMelech, so there was a civil war, and the Jewish kingdom split into two, what's known as the kingdom of Yehuda, Malchus Yehuda, and Malchus Yisrael. This is all in Navi. Okay, the two different, and that was, there's archaeological evidence and other evidence that during that period of time, after Shlomo HaMelech, the city was of Yerushalayim, while remaining the capital of the so-called southern kingdom, or Malchus Yehuda, the city was somewhat in decline. Malchus Yisrael, the other kingdom, which was the 10 tribes, that was to the north, and their capital was not Yerushalayim, their capital was Shechem. And there were a constant series of wars, which you can read about, all about in Malachim. You can see different nations attacked, and so on, Yerushalayim. Sometimes the Melech of Yehuda, who was from Again, the king, the head of Yehuda was from the Davidic line. It's a Malchus Beis David, father, son. It's from David HaMelech to Shlomo to Rechavim, and down the line, the king of Yehuda was from the king of the Judea, Judah. That part of the kingdom, the southern kingdom, was from Malchus Beis David. The northern kingdom, there was never any line, actually. I think the maximum was three. Okay, maybe four, I forgot. I think four. But other than that, it was never a father and son kind of thing. It was a different kind of political intrigue. That was Malchus Yisrael, again, based in Shechem, in what's called today Samaria, Shomron, and so on. In any event, as I say, the city of Yerushalayim was somewhat in decline, okay, and lost some of its importance. Again, it was still the site of the Beis Hamikdash, was still the capital of the Southern Kingdom, but again, we don't know the exact numbers, but a significant number of Jews did not live in that area and did not even come necessarily to Yerushalayim, to the Beis Hamikdash at all. So obviously it's important decline. In addition, as I said before, there were constant battles. Okay, Aram, A-R-A-M, Aram, Aleph Reish Mem, that was an enemy. Hazael was a king of Aram who fought against the Jewish people. The king Yehoash of Yehuda had to give away a lot of treasures in Yerushalayim to Aram, to Chazal, as a kind of a tax and so on. But the fact is, Yerushalayim remained the capital of the kingdom of Yehuda, of the southern kingdom, for approximately 400 years. Okay, specifically, or most importantly, it survived a siege by the next up-and-coming army, and that was Assyria, Ashur. Okay, Ashur, Assyria, not to be confused with what today we call Syria, although it's in the same general area. But the kingdom of Ashur was an up-and-coming kingdom. There were different houses of Assyria also. But they had a famous king called Sancheriv, or Sennacherib in English. I forgot which of the romantic poets who wrote the poem about Sennacherib. No, someone else. I think so. Anyway, famous Sancheriv. And Sancheriv, in the 700s BC, where it's still BCE, conquered the northern kingdom. And he led into exile the so-called the 10 tribes. That's how the 10 tribes got lost. When we speak about the lost tribes, they got lost because they didn't just, go for a walk in the woods one day. Okay, they got lost because they were exiled by Sancheriv and taken, and the policy at that time was, what many kings did, was when they conquered several territories, they simply removed the population of one to another, and the population of the other to the one. They mixed everybody up. This would do a couple of things. First of all, it would encourage intermingling and assimilation, and thereby discourage revolt. Okay, because you're with people who you didn't really know, and so on and so forth. And number two, you would lose what we call in sports the home field advantage, right? When you're fighting for your own land, you fight harder, right? When you're fighting for your own farm, for your own land. I mean, the American Revolution, so the colonists were able to defeat a vastly superior army, the British Army. Okay, they were fighting for their farm, and they're just fighting 3,000 miles away from home, rather not be there anyways. Right, so there's a difference, and that's repeated itself many times in history. So they understood that in the olden days too. So if you move someone to another, you don't know the area, you're not fighting for your own land, you don't know where the good hiding places are, where the good ambush, and so on. Anyway, so Sancheriv took away the 10 tribes, these tribes, and brought in other people to live there, including the land of Kuta, the Kutim, and so on. Anyway, so Sancheriv did not stop after knocking out the 10 tribes. He wanted to go on to conquer the southern kingdom as well, including Yerushalayim. He was not successful. Okay, he was not successful. Why was he not successful? So according to Chazal, according to us, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu performed the miracle and protected Yerushalayim, and saw to it that Yerushalayim would not in fact fall. Okay, that's not the record that we have in the Assyrian accounts of events, but eventually these Assyrian accounts say that he was bribed, that King Chizkiyo, who was the king of Yehuda at that time, would bribe Sennacherib and he left. Okay, again, Chazal tell us what they tell us, that Sancheriv, HaKadosh Baruch Hu called them, caused a miracle, and they ran away. Okay, but both our Tanakh and the Assyrian sources do confirm that there was, in fact, a mass movement of the population. I mean, that's not debatable. Okay, in terms of the Northern Kingdom and the so-called lost tribes of Israel. Now, as I say, Sancheriv did not conquer Yehuda for whatever the reason. Okay, he did besiege Yerushalayim, but eventually left, and Yerushalayim survived. Again, according to Chazal, Kadosh Baruch Hu protected Yerushalayim as a hope that this would inspire people to do tshuva. Unfortunately, it had the reverse effect because Jews began to get complacent. They figured, well, he's never going to destroy his city. It doesn't matter really what we do. And when Nevi'im like Yirmiyahu who of course is the Navi of Tisha B'Av, the author of Megillas Eicha, tried to warn people. Okay, I mean, the Megillas Eicha was actually written twice. It was written once and given to the king as a nevuah, what's going to happen, and the reaction was to burn it, destroyed it, because they didn't believe it's going to be true. Okay, it's not going to happen. And of course, it didn't happen. And that's why the psukim in Megillas Eicha, Rilat Lo Hamino Malchayeret, nobody believed it. Nobody could believe it. You know, you did this to your city and so on. But in any event, that was not until a little while later, because I said the Assyrian Ashur was the dominant empire, but Yerushalayim was left alone. Yerushalayim survived. The Assyrian army was eventually overthrown by the up-and-coming Babylonian Empire. And finally, in the year that at least in secular sources identified as 586 BCE, which is when Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. But first, we need to understand that 11 years before that, and it's all in Malachim Beis, okay, 11 years before, so again it's BCE, so we're working backwards, so in 597 BCE, the Babylonians conquered Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim fell. Okay, and that was really the first time Yerushalayim fell too. Again, Sennacherib was more than 100 years earlier, was unsuccessful. Sennacherib and his armies were successful in besieging Yerushalayim, who exiled, the king at that time was named Yehoyachin, or Yechonia. He was exiled together with, the Pesukim tell us, the so-called Choresh Maskev. Chazal understand it means the upper class, right? It's the upper class Jews, the intelligentsia, we might call it today, right? The people who were more accomplished, the people who were wealthier, they were exiled to Bavel 11 years before the Beis HaMikdash was ever destroyed, including Yechonia. According to what we says in, it says in Megillas Esther, Mordechai, from the Purim story, was among those exiled. I don't want to go into now the issue with the years, it's not a topic, but Pasuk says that we say, Ish Yehuda Hayah B'Shushan B'Yir Shmo Mordechai Ben Yor Ben Shimon Kish Ish Yemina Asher Hagla, that's one of the Pesukim we read in the Eichatun, Asher Hagla Mirushalayim, he was exiled from Yerushalayim, Im Hagola Asher Hagla Saw, with the exile that was exiled, Im Yechonya Melech Yehuda, Asher Hagla Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel. Now, the Pasuk says that, it says Mordechai Ben Yor Ben Shimon Ben Kish Ish Yemina Asher, he was exiled. So is it Mordechai, is it or is it Mordechai ben Yoyer, was his father, was it, who was the he? It says he was exiled. Was it Mordechai, or his father, or his grandfather? So again, this is not our topic today, historians debate it. Whatever it was, let's assume that Mordechai, for our purpose, Mordechai was exiled, you know, but again, so were many other Jews. Yechezkel HaNavi was exiled. Yechezkel HaNavi prophesied in Bavel, not in Eretz Yisrael, at least the recorded prophecy. He started in Eretz Yisrael, but he prophesied in Bavel. So many of the haftarahs that read from Sefer Yechezkel were prophecies that took place in Bavel. The very first parak of Yechezkel begins by saying, "Vani b'soch hagola on the Har Kivar." I was in exile. That haftarah is read in the first morning of Shavuos. Many people are not really awake when they. I read the haftarah, and I'm not awake. I have to lay in the haftarah, I have to sleep. But that's how the haftarah begins. Yechezkel parak aleph. "Vani b'soch hagola." I was in the exile. So Yechezkel, so many of the leading upper class Jews and a sort of a puppet kingdom was left in Eretz Yisrael. Tzidkio was the king. And unfortunately, things didn't work out. They didn't cooperate. In 586, 11 years later, after many of the Jews were exiled to Babylon already, Nebuchadnezzar's armies came in yet again. It was actually the third time, and destroyed the Beis HaMikdash on Tisha B'Av 586 BCE, and that's, of course, what we mourn today. So that was the fall of Yerushalayim from Jewish control in the year 586 BCE, and the exile, Tzidkio himself, was tortured. He was, you know, they executed his children in front of him, and then blinded and took out his eyes. That should be the last thing that he saw, was his own family being executed. And that was the end. A small group of Jews remained there with no king. Tzidkio was the last king. A small group of Jews remained in Yerushalayim under the stewardship of a gentleman by the name of Gedaliah ben Achikam, as in Tzom Gedaliah. Gedaliah ben Achikam was not a king. He was an appointee of the Babylonians, but he was an honest Jew and so on and so forth, and a good person, a tzaddik. He was put in control of this very small Jewish population that was left. Again, many were exiled to Babel 11 years before. Many of the rest were exiled to Babel in 586. A group, including Yemenov, ended up in Egypt. They were exiled over there. A small group of Jews remained in Yerushalayim, but an insignificant number of Jews. But Gedaliah ben Achikam was in charge of them. That lasted for a grand total, you can do the math yourself. That lasted from Tisha B'Av until the 3rd of Tishrei, okay, which is not too long. Okay, that experiment lasted 52 days. Okay, from today, from Tisha B'Av till the day we call Tzom Gedaliah, when a fellow Jews conspired to assassinate Gedaliah, he was assassinated, and we fast on that fast day, the third of Tishrei, called Tzom Gedaliah. Now, as I mentioned as a side point, there are some people who wonder why we fast. I mean, Gedaliah, sure, is a nice guy, but why are we fasting? Why do we have to have a whole fast? I mean, there were other tzaddikim, other great people who died, and you know, why do we fast on Tzom Gedaliah? You know, people say, why should I fast on Tzom Gedaliah? Would Gedaliah fast if I die? You know, but it misses the point. It misses the point because the Rambam makes it clear and the Chazal make it clear that it's not only the person of Gedaliah. He was a tzaddik, and it's a terrible story. I mean, he was ambushed. He was killed by fellow Jews, and he was warned. He was warned that people were conspiring. It wasn't Maccabi. They said Jews. He didn't accept the fact that fellow Jews are going to kill him, and he didn't take the proper precautions. So it's a tragic story. But more important than that, really, to be honest, is the idea that that was the end of Jewish sovereignty in Yerushalayim. Because at that point, the Babylonians didn't appoint any other Jews. So really, the Rambam's Lashon is there was a gacheles, there was a coal, an ember, you know, still burning, even after the Churban, even after Tisha B'Av. So Tisha B'Av wasn't really the end. Tisha B'Av was the end in terms of the Beis HaMikdash. But in terms of Jewish sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, that remained even after the Churban Beis HaMikdash for a short time. At least there was a Jew in charge by the name of Gedaliah. And after that, after Tzom Gedaliah, that was the end of any kind of Jewish sovereignty in Yerushalayim. So that was the end, that was the Churban. Now, according to Chazal, after 70 years, after 70 years, again, I'm going to the years and the issues now. There were discrepancies in terms of dates, which is not our topic now. But the Jews received permission from the Persians, who took over from the Babylonians. The Babylonian army of empire fell. Okay, the Persians took over. And the Persians had a couple of kings by the name of Koresh, Cyrus, a king called Daryovid. The Persians and the Medes merged at certain points. Like, for example, Megillus Esther, we read all the time, Chel Paras Umadai, right? Achashverosh ruled over 127 provinces, so it says they're Paras and Modai. Some of the kings were called Koresh, some were called Daryovish, and permission was granted to the Jews to return to Eretz Yisrael, to Yerushalayim, and even to build the Beis Hamikdash. The person put in charge there at that time was named Zerubbabel, not related to the name Bavel, but Zerubbabel was his name. He was from the family of King of David. He wasn't a king, but he was in charge. Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel. For those who never heard of him, you have heard of him. He's in Moz Tzur. Okay, it's Bavel, Zerubbabel. That's Zerubbabel, right? So that's the. He was in charge of that again at Kates Bavel at the end of Bavel. Zerubbabel, Kates Shivim No Shalti. That's what it says in Moz Tzur. At the end of the 70 years, we were saved and under Zerubbabel. But of course, the more dominant leaders following Zerubbabel were Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay, Ezra, who led the religious movement and brought many Jews back. Many Jews didn't come back. And Nehemiah, who was a powerful, you know, he was an organizer, and he had worked in the Persian government and so on. He built the walls. Okay, with Ezra, so I once heard Rabbi Wine describe when Ezra came in, said it was just another guy with a black hat. But when Nehemiah came in, he had an army, he had force, he had power and so on, and was able to build the walls of Yerushalayim again. That's the middle of the 5th century, roughly. Okay, but given permission by the Persian kings to the BCE, we're still talking BCE. And therefore, there was a reestablishment of Jewish presence in Yerushalayim. But again, I stress, no political sovereignty. They were under the control of the Persians. Now, there are different versions of what the Persians did, what they allowed. Was it some kind of a puppet kingdom? Was it some type of a client kingdom? So there are different opinions. But it's really at this time, the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, we have Ezra and Nehemiah, the books in the end of Tanakh and Divrei Hayamim describe it. There became what we would call today perhaps a theocracy. Okay, the office of the kahuna became very, very important. The leaders were the kohanim gedolim. Okay, but also there was at this time probably developed or the Jews honed or sharpened the notion of an exclusivity that we have as a people. That we are, not that this the concept of chosenness originates then, but perhaps because they've been in Golos before, they really emphasize this point of being, you know, we are our own people and so on. And Yerushalayim was the center. However, Yerushalayim was the center in terms of the Beis HaMikdash, but according to some records, in the Persian times, Yerushalayim had a very, very small Jewish population. Maybe 1,500, maybe less. Okay? An area in Binyamin called Mitzpah and so on and so forth, which had more people, but there was still a Jewish presence in Yerushalayim. And again, the walls built recently, as recently as 10 years ago, again in that Ir David area, they discovered remnants of walls from Nehemiah and so on. So we know that there was a Jewish presence there. Now, the next army that came in after Persia were the Greeks. It was the next up-and-coming empire. Okay, now you would think that Yerushalayim, is just not that important, but somehow if we think about it, I want you to picture, because you've probably seen this in history books, okay, primitive or ancient maps of the ancient world. And what you have is three things that look like three footballs. Okay, oblong, whatever the shape is, okay. One is Europe, one is Asia, one is Africa. And there's sometimes juxtaposed. You have these three football-shaped depictions of Europe, Asia, Africa. Well, if you think about it for 1 minute, okay, well, what's kind of in the middle, if you map it out that way? Yerushalayim. That's what it's called. It's called the Middle East for a reason. I don't mean that facetiously. Okay, it was understood to be the middle. It's where the action was. It's where things happened. It's really the crossroads of civilizations. So in Alexander the Great, first his father Philip Macedonian, but in Alexander the Great undertook a military campaign against Persia, okay? He conquered, he took a little bit of a detour to the south and conquered what's today Egypt and what is today Israel, okay? Now, Chazal have a narrative, okay? It's in the Gemara and Yuma. The Gemara says, and the great Jewish historian Josephus has this in his works also in Antiquities, okay? And the Jews were nervous about Alexander coming in. Why? Because they supported the Persians in this battle. The Jews of Yerushalayim, the Jews of Eretz Yisrael supported the Persians. Not, I think, because there was any great love for the Persians, but, pick your poison. We knew the Persians. They knew what to expect. They knew how to deal with them. They probably knew how to bribe them. They probably knew how to get things done. They were used to living under them. So what do we want? Someone new is going to say, a new sheriff in town is going to make new rules. So therefore, we don't want those rules. And of course, when it became clear that Persia was going to fall to Alexander, the Jews were nervous about it. So according to the Gemara, Shimon HaTzadik, who was very old at that time, Yishori Anshei Knesset Gedola, and again, I'm not going to years, Shimon HaTzadik was a Kohen Gadol, and he came out to greet Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great came to Jerusalem on his majestic horse. He had a special horse, a huge horse. Alexander himself was also a physically imposing person. Okay, and he comes in, and he sees whether it was Shimon HaTzadik, actually, was a descendant of Shimon HaTzadik, whoever it was. When he sees this Kohen Gadol, he dismounts from his horse, and he bows before this individual. And his attendants and his entourage are absolutely shocked. And they haven't seen Alexander get off his horse and bow to somebody else, certainly not with any kind of frequency. And according to the account of Josephus, okay, he was asked by his general to explain, what's it all about? What are you bowing to this guy for? And he answered, I did not bow before him, but before that God who has honored him with the high priesthood, for I saw this very person in a dream in this very apparel. He said that he would have a vision, a dream, when he went out to battle, he would see, would be inspired by a vision of an old man, with a beard, inspiring him to be successful in battle. And now he saw this person wearing those garments, the big day kahuna. Well, because of that, again, according to Chazal, everything worked out with Alexander. We do know that Alexander did not destroy Yerushalayim. We know that he did not destroy Yerushalayim. And we also know that he basically peacefully absorbed Eretz Yisrael in general, Yerushalayim included, into his. Yes, there were rules about taxes, but, as a thanks, so to speak, the Chachamim decreed that the children, Jewish children, should be given the name Alexander, which remains a Jewish name till today. And Alexander, or Sender in Yiddish, okay, that's Alexander. Alexander is a not uncommon Jewish name because things work out with Alexander. Now, the relation between the Greeks and the Jews was very, very interesting. Because the Greeks, as you know from history, the Greeks had certain cultural advances, whether in art and architecture and poetry and drama and so on, things that are very attractive. On the other hand, the Jew, they were kind of exotic, to the eyes of the Jews. They had an intellectual tradition, with Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Aristotle was a tutor, was a teacher of Alexander. Alexander was, in addition to a good general, was also an intelligent person. You know, love of wisdom, science, art, architecture, and so on. The Jews had never encountered that before. The Jews did not consider the Babylonians or the Persians, you know, I don't go into now, but the Gemara has disparaging remarks that Jews made about the Babylonians. They didn't consider them a civilized people in many ways. Okay, in some areas, but in many areas not. And they would consider themselves to be primitive, you know, a pagan primitive people. And suddenly they were encountering the Greeks, who you could not really describe as a primitive or pagan group. Okay, and so therefore the Greek language, in fact, was considered so beautiful. The Gemara says you can write a Sefer Torah in Greek and so on. You have to look at the Ephes. On the other hand, the Greeks had an interest in the Jews also, because this was a monotheistic people which they had never dealt with before. And the result of that was that after the time of Alexander, his empire split. They couldn't hold the empire together. The Greek empire split. The Greek empire split into initially three and subsequently two parts. One was based in Syria, in Damascus, and one was based in Egypt, in the city called, after Alexander, Alexandria. There are a few towns called Alexandria, but there's Alexandria of Egypt. And there were two different groups. The kings of the Egyptian branch were called Ptolemy. Okay, the Gemara calls Ptolemy HaMelech, Ptolemy, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, the sound P. And the Greeks, the people in the north, were the Seleucid kingdom. They were both Greeks. Okay, I've mentioned this in past years, because now you'll understand if you didn't understand it before. I mean, it took me a long time to understand it. I never understood exactly who the enemy was Hanukkah time. Somebody, the Greeks were the enemy, the Syrians were the enemy, the Syrian Greeks, the Greek Syrians. What the Syrians got to do with the Greeks? You know, who exactly? So we'll get to that in a second. But anyway, you had two branches. So Talmai, the second, Talmai Sheni, Ptolemy the second, the Gemara says, was the one who had the Torah translated into Greek, the so-called Septuagint, right? According to Chazal, he gathered 70 Talmidei Chachamim, and he got them into different rooms, 70 different rooms, you know, they all translated the exact same way. There was a nace that took place. Some wanted to quip that it would have been a bigger nace if they had agreed to being in the same room than if they were in 70 different rooms. But anyway, this nace took place, and the Torah was now in Greek. Okay, but at the same time, the Greek culture and the Greek religion was now becoming more attractive to Jews. And on the one, after all, we've a Sefer Torah can be written in Greek. The Torah was translated into Greek, right? I mean, what's so bad about it? And that's when you begin to have the movement of Hellenism and so on, and many Jews being won over to that culture because there's something very attractive about that culture. Okay, now one of the kings of the Northern Kingdom, several of the kings were called Antiochus, including the one who's known as Antiochus the Fourth. That's the Antiochus from Hanukkah. Okay, and why is it Syrian Greeks or Greek Syrians? Because it was the Syrian branch of the Greek Empire. It was a northern branch of the Greek Empire. Okay, and he's the one who promulgated all the decrees and so on. We all know the story from Hanukkah. Okay, the influence of Hellenistic culture, Jews using Greek names and many things along those lines. In Yerushalayim itself, to get back to Yerushalayim, because we're talking about Yerushalayim. So in Yerushalayim itself, there was really a rift, because there was a religious group in Yerushalayim who stayed on their own, who were economically not as successful as the religious Jews, okay, or the Hellenized Jews, who had important positions and so on. They were the minority, but they had certain civil rights and so on. And they controlled the economy, they controlled trade, they controlled local administration, and many times even controlled the Beis HaMikdash itself, the non-observant group. Now, the fact of the matter is, and historians have pointed out, that had this Antiochus left everything alone, it may well have been that many, many more Jews would have assimilated. However, Antiochus passed certain decrees, we all know from Hanukkah, he outlawed Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh and Bismillah and whatever else. Okay, well, Jews are such, oh, you're not going to tell me what to do. And then they're ready to revolt. They're doing it anyway. Oh, you're telling me to do this? Oh, no, wait a minute. That's when they woke up. Okay, so again, had he left things alone, it probably would have progressed in that direction. But as soon as he made it law, then but in all seriousness, of course, we know Matisyo and the five sons, the Maccabim, Yehuda Maccabee, and the brothers, and so on, Shimon, Yochanan, Elazar, and Yonasan, and Yehuda Maccabee. So they, we know, carried out a rebellion and were victorious. We know the story from Hanukkah. What that led to was what's called in secular history the Hasmonean period, the Hasmonai period, where you did have Jewish sovereignty over Yerushalayim. There was, now, Was it really complete sovereignty? It was and it wasn't. Okay, some of the Chashmonim called themselves Melech, much to the consternation of the Rabbanim, because they were not from Shevet Yehuda. They were, as we know, Kohanim. Right? They were from the family of the Kohanim. Matisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol. He was from the family of the Kahuna. So the descendants of the Chashmonim were Kohanim, and that's a question. How could they take over the Melucha? Kingdom has to come from Malchei Beis David. But okay, so the earlier Chashmonim were leaders, but never called themselves king. The later ones did not. Okay, and we also see some of the later Chashmonaim, a couple of generations down the road, okay, took on, you know, from being called Shimon, Yochanan, Eliezer, Yonasan, and Yehuda. We have John Hyrcanus, Yehuda Aristobulus, Alexander Yanai. They begin to take on the Greek names, and they were many ways they were Greeks. And of course, at this time we have the rift in Yerushalayim between the Tzedukim and the Purushim. The Tzedukim were the Sadducees who were in effect the successors to the Hellenists after the Greek, after the triumph of Hanukkah, and the Purushim were the Talmid Chachamim and so on. In any event, there were civil wars that broke out. Ultimately, a major civil war broke out between two brothers who were descendants of the Chashmonaim. One controlled part of Yerushalayim, the other controlled the other part of Yerushalayim. The one who controlled the part of Yerushalayim that included the Beis Hamikdash let the other side bring Karbonis still. In other words, because they were, it's a strange thing, they were from, but they were, non-religious. There were certain things, the temple, the Beis Hamikdash, that avoda they kept going. Okay? And so the advisor to that side said, well, of course you're not going to vanquish your opponent. You're letting him send in animals to be sacrificed for the korbanos. As long as he can send in animals, so then the Beis Hamikdash is going to protect them. So that's a famous episode where instead of sending up, and they weren't even allowed to come to the side, they had to send it up over a pulley, over a wall. Okay, they sent up a pig instead. Okay, they sent up a pig instead. And these are descendants of Matisyahu. And so that was the beginning of that. That was a civil war. They called in the Romans, and that was the beginning of the end in terms of the Bayis Sheni. I'll get to that back in a second. I just want to point out, if you go today in Yerushalayim, you will see areas where you have so-called Hasmonean walls, okay, Hasmonean water tunnels, and when you hear that on all these tours, that's in the time of the Chashmonaim. So the citadel known as Migdal David today, Migdal David, when you come into Shai Yafa, has nothing to do with David HaMelech. David HaMelech never saw it. Didn't exist in his time. Nothing to do with David HaMelech. Okay, it's called the citadel. That's from the Chashmonaim time in Mamila. Now there's a mall there, but you can see walls, in the Mamila, so-called Mamila area, Mamila walls. You can see walls from the time of the Chashmonaim and other such place as well, the base of the Harabayas. In the Jewish quarter, something called the Israelite Tower, those have been there. You can see today walls from the time of the Chashmonaim because they did build up certain fortresses. Now, the Romans came in at the request originally. Okay, but that's like asking the fox to come in and take care of the argument between the chickens. Okay, because now this was an entree to the Romans and a very dark period of Jewish history. Herod, okay, was a Roman, was not Jewish. He wanted to be liked by the Jews. He considered himself a Jew. He married the last remnant of the Chashmonai family. He ruled starting in 37 BCE and they captured Yerushalayim. And again, rebuilt Yerushalayim into a magnificent city. To the point that as crazy as Herod was, and he killed people and so on, he killed his own family out, he tortured people, and he fought with the Rabbanan, and he executed many members of the Sanhedrin, etc., etc. A lot of stories you can give a whole class on Herod, and then some. But, despite all of that, the Gemara says that anyone who never saw the Beis Hamikdash of Herod never saw a beautiful building. When we see models of the Second Temple today in pictures and on posters and postcards, you can buy them and the exhibit, it used to be in the Holy Land Hotel, now it's in the Israel Museum and so on. That is Yerushalayim from the time of Herod, the beautiful structure, the beautiful marble building and so on and so forth. That beautiful building was built by Herod. That was Yerushalayim in terms of, he made Yerushalayim a city that people wanted to go visit. In fact, Pliny the Elder, writing of Herod's achievement, called Jerusalem the most famous by far of the eastern cities, not only the cities of Judea. He made it into a center, he made it into a place that was, he also built, by the way, Caesarea, which you can go visit today also. They have golf courses there, those who play golf. But anyway, the point is that Herod built a lot of different things, including Yerushalayim. So that was really a high point for Yerushalayim in terms of its splendor, in terms of its beauty, but a low point in terms of the Jews because the religious state of affairs was very, very bad. And after Hera died, and we're now crossing over into the common era, okay, after the year one, okay, now you had among the Jews, I don't know how many Jews, how many opinions, whatever, there are more opinions than Jews, but more or less a major issue as to how to solve and work with the Romans. The Romans were the dominant empire in the world, okay? The Prussian, which was the observant Jews, that was the majority. They were headed by the Sanhedrin, the Hillel and Shammai at that time, in that era. They were more moderate. They didn't want to fight and so on. Others say, no, you have to fight to the death. Others have a different opinion. And at the same time, different religious groups are cropping up in Yerushalayim, all in Yerushalayim. Okay, so you have the Essenes, okay, who eventually left Yerushalayim. You have the early Christians, early Christianity. Okay, that's why the early Christian, some of their holy sites are right in Yerushalayim today, because that also cropped up at that time. And there were Gentiles who continued to be drawn to Judaism at that time. So we know in the Gemara of someone called Helena Hamalka. Okay, Helena Hamalka. There's a Rechov Helena Hamalka in Yerushalayim. There's also Rechov Shlom Tzion Hamalka. She was one of the bright spots in the Hasmonean period. She was Queen Salome, Shlomo Alexandria, Shlom Tzion Hamalka. But anyway, this is Helena Hamalka. She had a son called Munbaz. You may have heard of him. Okay, these were non-Jews, but Helena Hamalka did everything according to the Chachamim. The Gemara says she built the sukkah in accordance with the Chachamim's direction, so on and so forth. So people began. So you had all these different groups in Yerushalayim, in Yerushalayim. And it was a revolt against the Romans, an attempt to overthrow the Romans. And again, many, many different opinions as to how to solve the problem. Okay, well, in Yerushalayim, it was the Zealots who were in control most of the time, and they prohibited making any kind of deals with the Romans. In fact, they, Jews themselves, burned the food supply so that people would fight even harder to the death. They'd fight for your life. So you had, as I say, an extremist, a significant extremist view. It was against this backdrop that Chazal tell us that Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the chief rabbi, snuck out of Yerushalayim. How did he sneak out of Yerushalayim? He let the word out, or he had his students get the word out that he had died. Okay? He hadn't died. He was fine. And they put him in a coffin, and they didn't bury it to this day. We don't bury in Yerushalayim. We bury right outside. There are no cemeteries in Yerushalayim proper. Okay? So they took the coffin out, and the whole parade, or whatever it was, allegedly go bury him. And then when they were outside, he hopped out and he went and made a deal with then the general besieging Yerushalayim, Vespasian, who later became the emperor. And he saved Judaism by transferring the Chachamim to Yavne and so on. So Yerushalayim at that point was surrendered. He surrendered Yerushalayim basically. And ultimately the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. I want you to think for a moment of what kind of decision that must have been for Yochanan ben Zakkai. He surrendered Yerushalayim. And there are evidence in the Gemara that he went to his deathbed wondering whether he had done the right thing. Okay, that must have persecuted him and tormented him internally for the rest of his life. Yochanan ben Zakkai gave up Yerushalayim. He gave up Yerushalayim, he felt, because he had to save Torah and had to save Judaism. But Yerushalayim fell, second Beis HaMikdash destroyed, Tisha B'Av and so on. We know in the hands of Titus. We know that that was a big victory for them. We know that on the arch of Titus in Rome today, you can see leading the menorah away. We know that they minted a coin, Judea Capta, Judea has fallen and so on and so forth, has been captured. Okay, I do want to mention that this battle and everything were not without casualties. According to Josephus, 1,100,000 Jews perished during these battles with Rome. So it's not nothing. I mentioned the Kinnis this morning. We often say, well, Kadosh Baruch Hu had mercy, took out his wrath against the Eitzim Avonim, against the building, which is true. He didn't wipe out the Jewish people in its entirety, but 1,100,000, according to Josephus, and another 97,000 were taken captive. So it was tremendous human loss in Yerushalayim as well. Okay? Basically, Yerushalayim, after this, was kind of left in ruins. Okay? Josephus writes that Jerusalem was so thoroughly razed to the ground by those that demolished it to its foundation that nothing was left that could ever persuade visitors that it had once been a place of habitation. It was so thoroughly destroyed and so thoroughly ruined that people didn't believe that it had once been a city. And by the way, in Echo we say it, even though it's not told with the second base. I say, here, is this the city that people said, Klios Yofi, Misos Kalaret? This is the beautiful city? Well, it was even worse after the Bayesheni. Now, the Roman Emperor Hadrian, around the year 130, now we're in the Common Era, initially seemed to allow the Jews to build another Beis HaMikdash. He had a Medrash matches, by the way, the Medrash like that. But some of the Jewish enemies foil. They'll stop that. It's in the Medrash. And they told him, you're going to let them build, they're going to revolt against you. And so he stopped it. And of course, he went the other way, the Bar Kokhba rebellion, which wasn't necessarily sent to Yerushalayim. But the Bar Kokhba rebellion, after that, Hadrian was fed up. And at that point, Hadrian removed Jews from the city after the Bar Kokhba revolt, approximately 130 or so of the Common Era. Jews were no longer allowed to live in Yerushalayim. And this was the status quo for several centuries. No Jews lived in Yerushalayim. It's hard to imagine today. No Jews in Yerushalayim. In fact, he renamed the city. He didn't call it Jerusalem anymore. He named it after Roman gods, particularly Jupiter Capitolina. He called it Aelia Capitolina. Aelia was a reference somehow to his name. Okay, and the whole Judea he called Syria Palestina. He's the one who first called it Palestine. Okay, the Palestinians, the Palestine was the name given to the area by the Romans as a slap in the Jews' face, because Philistines were the enemy, traditional enemies of the Jews in Tanakh, in Nevi'im. So he called it Syria Palestina. It wasn't called Judea anymore, and the city was renamed, they said, Aelia Capitolina. It was rebuilt as a Roman city. Okay, as a side point, it was set up, the physical setup of Aelia Capitolina, again, Tarsus, Yerushalayim. No Jews lived there. The city was set up like a typical Roman city, which had a north-south road called a cardo. Okay, those who have been to the old city know now where the cardo is. Okay, that was a north-south road called the cardo, and an east-west road called Decumanus, which intersect in the middle. Okay, and the old city of Yerushalayim has that layout still today. Okay, you can, you know, there's one main thoroughfare that goes in this direction and one main thoroughfare that goes in that. A lot of side thoroughfares was built, you know, it's the basic layout of the city, remarkably, is the same way it is today. Jews, I said, were not allowed to enter into Yerushalayim at this time, okay, for several centuries. There was one exception, not one person, one day there was an exception. That's today, Tisha B'Av. On Tisha B'Av, the Jews were allowed into Yerushalayim to cry, to lament the Mikdash. Lament what they had. That was almost like a torture. One day of the year, Tisha B'Av, they mourned the Churban, they were allowed to come in then. But that was it. As far as the Romans were concerned, it was a relatively unimportant town. Okay? Now, when the Roman Empire became Christian, the Emperor Constantine, we're now in the 300s, okay? Well, he rebuilt Jerusalem as a center of Christian worship. He built up what's today called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and so on and so forth, which is, and various other churches, which we have today. But until that time, until the time of Constantine, and even after, Aelia remained the official name of the city, and even the Arabs called it that as well. Just to give a parallel, at around the time that Constantine was building up the city as a Christian city, that's when Hillel II, not Hillel of Vesel, but Hillel II, set up the Jewish calendar, the so-called Hillel Hasheni, and so on. There was a brief respite. There was an emperor by the name of Julian, not Julius Caesar, Julian. 361 to 363, he abolished the taxes the Jews had to pay in the land, and he gave permission to Jews to come into Yerushalayim. Okay, and they did. In fact, he even initiated possibly the restoration of building a Beis HaMikdash. However, there was an earthquake in Yerushalayim, and Julian died unexpectedly, and he again only reigned for 2 years, and that was the end of the good news. And so for another couple of centuries, the Roman Empire, again, controlled it. It was actually, by that point, the Roman Empire itself had split. So it was the Byzantine branch of the Roman Empire controlled Jerusalem, and again, the Jews were not allowed in. 638, the Byzantine Jerusalem was conquered by the Arab armies of someone named Omar ibn al-Khattab. If you go into the old city, you can see there's the square near Shai Yafo. It's called Omar ibn al-Khattab Street. I think in Hebrew it says Rehov David. It says something else. But no, I'm kidding. But it says Omar ibn al-Khattab. Okay, one of those main streets when you first come into the old city. Omar ibn al-Khattab, 638. A Muslim conquered the city. Okay, and actually he referred to the area of the Temple Mount as Madinat Bayit el-Maqdis. If I'm pronouncing it right. Someone knows Arabic is here, right? But the site of the temple, right? The site of the Mikdash, okay? And the rest of the city was still called Ilya. So they divided the names of the city. It was still called Ilya from Aelia Capitolina of Hadrian, but it was the Temple Mount was called the Temple Mount, okay? In any event, now it was under Muslim control, basically for 300 plus years, okay? But the population of the city declined. The Jews were allowed back in, okay, Jewish community, and began to grow a little bit. And it was basically for the first time after 500 years of Christian rule, Jews could enter into the city. Jewish families from elsewhere in the Eretz Yisrael moved to Yerushalayim in an attempt to populate the city, but the Muslims were building it up themselves. And it was in 691 that the so-called Dome of the Rock, okay, was built. Okay, the Muslims, I'm sorry, it was, and 15 years later in 705, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. No record in the old records of any metal detectors there, but they built up the Mosque of Omar. It was called Mosque of Omar. This is different Omar, Omar Abdul Aziz. Okay, and at that point in 720, the Jews were banned from going onto the Makam HaMikdash. They could not worship on the Temple Mount, which remains into effect to this day. I'm not going to politics right now, but that was basically for the next 1,000 years or so, and more really. The Jews were not allowed to worship on the Temple Mount, although they could be in Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem is not mentioned, as I mentioned before, in the Quran either, not mentioned anywhere in the Quran, but according to the, I don't know how to describe the Hadith, I guess the Torah Shebaal Peh, what would it be? That's the oral traditions of the Muslims, huh? The Medrash, right, according to their oral traditions, so Muhammad ascended to heaven from Jerusalem, from the Al-Aqsa, where the Dome of the Rock is, okay, and so therefore the city does have significance, and they built that mosque to him, to the so-called night journey, huh?
On the top,
right, okay, so however he made it, he got up there somehow, following as Gabriel, who I guess flew ahead, but anyway, they built their mosque. So Jews were not allowed to be there, but again, Jerusalem did prosper as a city under the Muslims. In the 10th century, it was described as the most fertile province of Palestine, okay? Although it never received the political attention, but at least it was a place where people lived. The Jews didn't care about the political. There are records of German Jews living in the 11th century. But then, of course, came the period of the Crusades, okay? When the Christians came back on the scene from Europe, and their basic goal was to liberate Jerusalem from the hands of the Muslims. Jerusalem's our holy city. We've got to liberate the city and so on and so forth, and to bring back the glory of Christianity. And when they came in 1099, the siege of Jerusalem was a one-month siege, and the Jews who defended Jerusalem against the Crusaders, because they're having it pretty good, comparatively speaking, under the Muslims, when the city fell, most of the city's Muslim and Jewish inhabitants were slaughtered. The city was described by some as knee-deep in blood. Okay, a massacre of 6,000 Jews tried to protect themselves by going to a shul, but they burnt the shul in Yerushalayim. They burnt the shul down, and this was something which was obviously a significant turning point. The Christians rebuilt part of Yerushalayim when the Christian part of Yerushalayim, okay, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was built. You know, it has a. People think that the dome means it's a mosque. It's not true. Okay, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre has a dome. The Kevaroch had a dome. It was just a construction because of the water and so on going off the top. But in any event, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre that you see today was built at that time. Under the Crusades, and they set up military orders. There was a military order of knights who were put in charge of the Temple Mount. You've heard of the Knights Templar. That's what they called the Knights Templar because they were in control of the Temple Mount. Okay, and the city had revival, again, under the Christians. Just to give you some Jewish factors, the fact, the 1100s, the Rambam visited Yerushalayim, and he davened by the Mokom HaMikdash. Okay, there was a reference in another Sefer, the Sefer Charedim, that the Rambam established Yontif on the day that he made it to the Mokom HaMikdash. In 1141, a little bit earlier, Yehuda Halevi wanted to get Jews to go to Yerushalayim. According to the story, he never made it himself, or he made it but then was trampled when he first got there. The great traveler Benjamin of Tudela, 1173, visited Yerushalayim, described it as a small city, and they said about 200 Jews live in the city near the what's called Migdal David. Anyway, the Muslims are the ones that reconquered it under Salah ad-Din or Saladin. You can see at the end is a street in Yerushalayim, Rehov Salah ad-Din, right outside, I think it's right outside the Shaar Shechem area, the Damascus Gate area, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, he reconquered it by the Muslims. And basically, there were various different Muslim groups. And the time doesn't admit, there were the Mamluk group. The Mamluks were actually, the Muslims kidnapped Europeans, okay, men, women, and children, and converted them to Islam and brought them in. They wanted to set up we've heard the word today, you know, a caliphate. Anyway, but the Muslims were in control of Yerushalayim under different people, and how they treated the Jews also differed. Okay, eventually it fell to the hand, and we have, by the way, Ravadia Batanura, the commentary on the Mishnah, traveled to Yerushalayim, and he found a forsaken, this is in, by 1481, after these different Muslims groups, a mamluk of different groups, back and forth, he found a shell community of 70 poor Jewish families, okay, in Eretz Yisrael in 1488. He tried to build it up, okay. But the fact of the matter is, there were other spurts of times where Jews tried to get to Yerushalayim. So, for example, back in the 1200s, none other than the Ramban himself came to Yerushalayim. Okay, the Ramban not only came to Yerushalayim, but tried to get people to come to Eretz Yisrael. Ramban made Aliyah in 1267, okay, and established a shul that's called today the Ramban Synagogue. You can see it today. Okay, well, it looked exactly like that as a question, but obviously, you know, there have been changes, but that's the Ramban shul, which is considered the oldest active shul in Yerushalayim. So that was set up by the Ramban. It had, the Mamluks were in charge at that time, and it was basically a place, you know, of exile for out of favor public officials and the Muslims. It wasn't an important city. And it was ruled by a relatively low-ranking Muslim person. And Ramban built the city. Ramban writes that when he came to Yerushalayim, he did not get a minyan in Yerushalayim. That's how few Jews lived in Yerushalayim in 1267. Couldn't get, according to one version, there were two brothers living there. Okay, and he tried. He brought a Sefer Torah from elsewhere and tried to establish a community and so on. A little early in the 1200s, some of the Balei HaTosis, the Rash Mishans, Rav Shimshon Rav Mishans, Rav Samson of Sens, okay, from France, came and tried to get Jews to immigrate. And some did, some came. Okay, and but again, it wasn't that long lasting in terms of its long term significance in terms of the Jews. Now, by 1517, and for the next 400 years, we'll get into modern times to wrap up. By 1517, the so-called Ottoman Empire took over control. There was a gentleman modestly named Suleiman the Magnificent, and again, you'll see you can see who rebuilt many of the walls. The standard walls that we see today around Yerushalayim were built, again, over other walls or in association with other walls, but a lot of them were built by Suleiman the Magnificent. Okay, the walls around the old city. Again, some of the foundations you can see today, differences in style of you know, sometimes you go on these tours and the guides going on and on about how these stones came from the Hasmonean period, these stones came from that period, these came from the other period, there's the Mamluk period. Okay, it's true though, because, you know, Yerushalayim was taken over so many times. Okay, we've all been on those tours. So the idea is that, but Suleiman the Magnificent built the walls that we know of today, you know, more or less the walls that we see around the old city today. It was under his time and subsequent Ottoman sultans that there was religious peace, more or less. Jews were allowed to live in Yerushalayim, were allowed to worship there, Christians, Muslims, okay. Again, they couldn't go on the Har HaBayis, but the Jews, the only thing is that the Jews were second-class citizens. So the Christians, you know, they were second-class citizens. The great Talmud Chacham, the Radbaz, who wrote a Tshuvas, he wrote a comment on the Rambam, came in 1569, came to Yerushalayim, but there were high taxes imposed on the Jews. So he went to Tzfat. Okay, in 1610, the Yochanan ben Zakkai shul, again, you can see it today, right, in the Jewish quarter, Yochanan ben Zakkai shul was built, and it came like the main shul for the Sfardim. And in 1700, Yehuda HaChosid, not the famous Yehuda HaChosid, but somebody else, came and built what's called the Churva Synagogue, right, which for a while was, all you saw was the, you know, the arch on the top, like in St. Louis, all you saw was just that shape, but then eventually it was rebuilt, and you can daven there now. The Churva Synagogue was built and so on. It was during the this era, okay, in the 1800s now, that Jews began to immigrate. More Jews began to come. However, they were not coming yet, this is pre-Zionism, they were not coming yet to rebuild Yerushalayim. Many Jews were coming, I want to say to, you know, grimly, but to die in Yerushalayim. They came there to die and be buried in the Har HaZeisim. You know, it was a Sephardi community. There was a small group of Ashkenazis that come from Europe in their old age because they wanted to die in Yerushalayim. And it wasn't really yet becoming, you know, an interest of Jews to go build up Yerushalayim, even though, as I said, they lived there in relative peace in the Ottoman period. Okay? But in the mid-1800s, there was an interest in expanding the city outside the walls of the old city. It was in that time where the first settlements outside the walls. So if you know where the windmill is, right beneath the windmill, what's called Mishkanot Shananim, okay, those rows of homes, now they're, I think Now they're very expensive, and artist quarters and whatnot in that area. Okay, that was the first. Mishkanot Shananim was the first, one of the first neighbors. The other was the area called the Russian Compound. That's where the police headquarters are. Okay, when you come out to Kikar, what's called Kikar Tzal, they now have the light rail. So right across from there is what's called the Russian Compound. That was also one of the first areas outside the Russian Compound, Mishkanot Shananim. But in any event, we'll come back to that in a second. By the mid-19th century, the Ottoman Empire was in decline. And it was corrupt, and it was run from Turkey, and it was basically, Yerushalayim was a backwater town. I mean, no one was interested in it particularly. It did not have a major population. It was about 8,000 people living there, but again, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, okay, and also Armenians. And the old city was divided more or less into the quarters. Again, it's not exactly correct. Okay, it's not the case that no Jews lived in what's called today the Arab, the Muslim quarter and so on. There were Jews, especially near the coastal. But in any event, more or less, that was a division of the city into Jewish quarter, Christian quarter, Muslim quarter, and Armenian quarter. And again, you could further subdivide each one of those different types of Jews. There were different types of Christians, different types of Muslims. But anyway, those were the territories. Now, the Muslims maintained control over what they called Haram HaSharif, which is the Temple Mount. Okay, the Christians lived in the vicinity of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, that's the northwest. The Jews mostly above the coastal Moravian, what's today called the Jewish Quarter, near Shaar Tzion, and Armenians were, when you first come in, by Shaar Yafo. Okay, now, in the mid-19th century, and I'll move to finish, in the mid-19th century, there were a number of important changes. Number one, again, immigration. Again, many people were coming to die there, but this was now the rise of Zionism, of Jews coming. There was also an age of Christian religious revival. Many churches began to send missionaries because they hoped that populating Jerusalem would hasten what they called the second coming and so on and so forth. Okay, and many people felt that the collapse of the Ottoman Empire was imminent, and therefore they wanted to build up their toehold there. And the Muslims, again, had their own... The Europeans in general had colonial ambitions. We know about colonialism in Africa and so on. So, you know, different European countries tried to get a toehold in Yerushalayim as well. The Muslims remained more or less the same. They were in charge. Now, the whole city, you know, it's about a square mile, the whole old city. And what's all the fuss about, right? It's a whole, you know, all this fighting and so on and so forth for so many centuries. And the whole area is a square mile. It was already overcrowded by the 1860s. And as I said before, okay, the Russian Orthodox Church built a complex outside the city called the Russian Compound. Okay, as I mentioned before, Mishkanot Shananim. Sir Moses Montefiore played a major, major role in trying to get Jews to move outside. Yamin Moshe, which is where the windmill is, right near Mishkanot Shananim. Okay, yes, several different areas are called something Moshe in Yerushalayim after the Zichron Moshe, and then various other things which are named his honor because he spent money to get Jews to come and live there. In fact, Jews were afraid. They paid people. Now this Mishkanot Shananim, you know, it's a very swanky area. They paid people to live there because, you know, everyone was afraid to go outside the city walls. In fact, some people took the money, they moved in there at night, they would come back into the old city. They'd be afraid to stay out there. Nachla Shiva, near Kikar Tzion. Nachla Shiva. You can walk through today, you see the old schools. Nachla Shiva, another one of the early settlements outside Nachla Ot. Okay, Maskeret Moshe, founded by Moses Montefiore in his Ashkenazi neighborhood, right next to that old Moshe, which he founded in the Sephardi neighborhood, the Nissen Beck houses, those who are familiar, Nissen Beck, okay, which is near Shaar Shechem, in that area. So many Jews, Jews tried to build up areas outside of the old city. Okay, how are they supported? So here you'll sometimes hear the term Kolel. You hear the term Kolel Chabad, Kolel Chibas Yerushalayim. Okay, Kolel Ungvar, Kolel Shomer HaChomos. This is not Kolel in the sense of somebody sitting and learning. And Kolel basically meant what you had was Jews in different countries supported members or residents or countrymen of theirs to go live in Yerushalayim. Okay, nothing to do with sitting and learning. Many people did sit and learn, but that wasn't Kolel like we use the term today. So when you see signs in Yerushalayim today, or you see old stuckabouts, you get in the mail, I still get, I'm sure all you get it also. Kolel Chibus Yerushalayim, Kolel Chabad, okay, it was basically set up by European countries, to Jews in European countries, to support Jews from their country. So you had Polish Jews and Russian Jews, Volhynian Jews, and so on, living in different places, supported by those so-called the old yeshuv. Okay, your Kol Chabad was a Russian Hasidim. Okay, there's something called Kol Poland. Okay, Kol Vilna, Kol Chibush Yerushalayim was from Galicia. The Hungarian, the Kol Shomer HaChomos. All the, and they raised money, and they had what's called a chalukah, and they would send the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim at that time, the chief rabbi for 70 years. In the 1800s was Shmuel Salant. Shmuel Salant would, in fact, be in charge of the distribution of this chalukah, of this money, to support the Jews who were living there. Okay, but again, this is important. After 1850, more or less, you had these... and of course, there was a little bit of a splintering in the Jewish community, therefore, as a result of that, there were all kinds of difficulties in terms of chalukah, but, and the Sfaradim had their own chacham, they called the Rishon Lezion, who was their chief rabbi. Okay. In any event, that was the structure of the, as the turn of the century to the 20th century, 1900 came, that was the setup. In 1917, the Ottoman Empire fell as a result of World War I. The Ottoman Empire on the losing side, they're on the German side. The British were on the winning side, and of course the British took over and established from 1917 to 1947 what we call the British Mandate. I'll just read to you. November 2nd, 1917, a letter written by Arthur James Balfour to Lord Rothschild. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which have been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. Quote, His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment of Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. That's the so-called Balfour Declaration, November 2nd, 1917. By the time General Allenby took over Yerushalayim from the Ottomans in 1917, the city outside the walls was basically like a patchwork of different communities, which each had its own distinct ethnic background, as we mentioned before. And the old city was basically, at that point, just the old neighborhood. It's like the people moved to the suburbs, you know. So the city was just the old, and that's more or less what the old city of Yerushalayim was like. And we know about the Arab riots, okay, and it wasn't, you know, it was very significant. Okay, 1920, 1929, and the 1930s were Arab riots in Yerushalayim, which led to several deaths. Okay, in the 1930s in Yerushalayim, the Hadassah Medical Center was built, and the Hebrew University was established on Mount Scopus, Har Tzofim, right outside the city. And eventually, British rule became so, you know, the British mandate was supposed to be from 1917 to 1947 for the purpose of showing the people there how to govern themselves. It was a failed experiment, and by the time 1947 rolled around, the British were only too happy to leave. They couldn't wait to get out, even though they knew that as soon as they get out, the population would start killing each other, which is what happened. Okay. In 1948, of course, was the was the War of Independence, and the old city of Yerushalayim was lost. I just want to mention about the holy sites, because people speak about that today. Jordan ransacked 57 ancient shuls, libraries, and center of religious study in the old city of Yerushalayim. 12 were totally and deliberately destroyed. Those that remained standing were defaced, used for housing of both people and animals. Appeals were made to the United Nations and the international community to declare the old city to be an open city and to stop this destruction, but there was no response. In 1950, the Knesset passed a resolution stating that Yerushalayim was the capital of Israel. But they did not have the old city. The old city was built, was under Jordanian control. Jewish religious sites, I mentioned, were turned into chicken coops and animal stalls. Okay, the Jewish cemetery on Har HaZeisim was defaced and defiled. This intercontinental hotel was built there. You can see it's still there today, of course. And graves were demolished to make way for a roadway to the hotel. Tombstones were used. I remember still, I've mentioned this in past years, when I was in Eretz Yisrael for a year, in my so-called gap year in the late 1970s, Kohanim could not go on the road that went near Har HaZeisim because they went right. There were so many graves, the road was right through. Kohanim, when I remember, was on a regular Eged bus. Kohanim couldn't go through. I still remember that. In 1950, talking about illegal annexation, okay, Jordan annexed the territories that won the 1948 war, specifically against, you know, what the United Nations had allowed. Most people didn't recognize it. Nonetheless, it was symbolic, and they denied, of course, Jews the right to come to pray anywhere in even Israeli Arabs, were not allowed, and no Israelis were allowed in. We just celebrated, and with this I'll finish, 50 years since the reunification of Yerushalayim in 1967 in the Six-Day War. We know the paratroopers advanced to the Old City. They came in and established Yerushalayim under Jewish control, independent Jewish control, for the first time in 2,000 years. It is impossible for me to conceive of how anybody who has any religious sensibility, I don't care which political group, I would say it to the face of anybody, from whatever Haredi, whatever, you know, I don't care. And I'm not saying, it's not a political issue. You have Jewish sovereignty over Yerushalayim, the whole Yerushalayim, including the Harbais, for the first time in 2,000 years. How anybody could not see the significance of that is absolutely beyond me, regardless of politics. Okay, it's significant, you know, for the first time in 2,000 years. And Jews can go daven there, and of course we've all seen pictures of a soldier standing there, of Shlomo Goren blowing the shofar and so on. But I want to share with you, just to end, I'm sorry we're going a little bit over, I think it's worth... it's worth hearing. You just have to hear some of the comments of the Jewish soldiers, the military command, not observant Jews. Okay? Not Shomer Torah Mitzvahs. Mota Gur was the commander of the force in the Old City. For some 2,000 years, the Temple Mount was forbidden to the Jews. Until you came, you, the paratroopers, and returned it to the bosom of our nation. The Western Wall, for which every heart beats, is ours once again. Many Jews have taken their lives into their hands throughout our long history in order to reach Jerusalem and live here. Endless words of longing have expressed the deep yearning for Jerusalem that beats within the Jewish heart. You have been given the great privilege of completing the circle, of returning to the nation, its capital, its holy center. Jerusalem is yours forever. That's what Mota Gur said to the paratroopers. Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, upon reaching the Western Wall, quote, "We have returned to all that is holy in our land. We have returned never to be parted from it again." Close quote. General Uzi Narkis, head of Central Command during the Six-Day War, quote, "The wall was before us. I trembled. There it was, as I had known it, immense, mighty, in all its splendor. Overcome, I bowed my head in silence." Close quote. Chief of Staff Yitzhak Rabin, "I felt truly shaken and stood there murmuring a prayer for peace. Mota Gur's paratroopers were struggling to reach the wall and touch it. We stood among a tangle of rugged, battle-weary men who were unable to believe their eyes or restrain their emotions. Their eyes were moist with tears, their speech incoherent. The overwhelming desire was to cling to the wall, to hold on to the great moment as long as possible." Again, these are not Shomer Torah Mitzvahs, just Jews. And here, of course, Rav Shlomo Goren, later the Rav Rashi, then the military, Tzal, Rav. "I am speaking to you from the plaza of the Western Wall, the remnant of our holy temple. Comfort my people, comfort them, says the Lord your God." "This is the day we have hoped for. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. The vision of all generations is being realized before our eyes. The city of God, the site of the Temple Mount and the Western Wall, the symbol of the nation's redemption, have been redeemed today by you, heroes of the Israeli Defense Forces. By doing so, you will fulfill the oath of generations. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its coming. Indeed, we have not forgotten you, Jerusalem, our holy city, our glory. In the name of the entire Jewish people in Israel and in the diaspora, I hereby recite with supreme joy the bracha," and he says, Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has kept us in life, who has preserved us, enabled us to reach this day, this year in Jerusalem, rebuilt." That was Rav Shlomo Goren. Again, it was a chaplain of the Israeli Defense Forces. Some lesser known event, I want to share it with you, and a different perspective of it. Again, the east part of Jerusalem was captured in 1967 on this day. It was a battlefield. Many of you, probably most of you, have heard the radio recording of what was going on, or some form of it. You've seen videos about it and so on. This story is not as well known. There were two rabbis, there were two rabbanim were not on the battlefield, obviously. Ratzvi Yehuda Cook, who was the son of Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, the first chief rabbi of Israel, and the so-called Nazir of David Cohen, they called him the Nazir, he was a Nazir. His son was of Shai Yosef Cohen, who just passed away, he was chief rabbi of Haifa many years. Anyway, Ratzvi Yehuda Cook wrote the following. "In the Six-Day War, Hashem brought us to an even greater height. You have guided them with your might to your holy dwelling place." All right, I'm sorry. After he spoke... He spoke about Yerushalayim, and it's important. Here's the part that we really want to bring to your attention. "It is impossible to forget that day," recall. That's the day the coastal was captured. Yerushalayim was captured. "Already for several days, the situation in the city was tense. If you've gone to Eretz Yisrael, you've not gone to the the museum at Ramat HaMakshin by Ammunition Hill, I urge you to do it. Because if you haven't been there, you have to see it. Because, you know, again, we celebrate, but it was quite there was loss of life and quite a battle. If you haven't seen that museum, you should see it. It is impossible to forget that day as Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook taught. Already for several days, the situation in the city was tense. Many yeshiva students had enlisted in the war. On the second day of the week, the 26th of Iyar, a student approached me as I was walking to the morning prayers at the yeshiva. He told me that the war had begun and that the Arab Legion was boasting that it would conquer all of Yerushalayim. Rumors reached me about battles on the outskirts of the city. A friend phoned me and related the name of Rav Shlomo Gorin, the Israel Defense Force chief rabbi, that Tzal units were advancing and getting closer to the old city of Jerusalem. This was nerve-trembling news. Each hour, expectation quickened. One of the students who had enlisted raced back to the yeshiva during an hour break and announced that tomorrow, with the Almighty's help, our paratroopers will reach the Kosel. All of us were filled with hope and trembling. On the fourth day of the week, an officer knocked on the door of my house. He had come with a message from Rav Gorin. The message was, "The Rav is invited by the chief rabbi of the army to come now to the Kosel. An armored car is waiting downstairs." Harav David Cohen, the Nozer Zatzal, joined us on the way. He too had been invited by his son-in-law of Gorin. The army car progressed slowly amidst the joyous crowds who were thronging the streets of the city. Thousands of singers, and still in the new part of the city, thousands of singing and dancing people. Many of them had tears of joy in their eyes over the liberation of Jerusalem. On the way, the officer told me that the moment the paratrooper had reached the perimeter of the Kosel, a soldier, who was a student at our yeshiva, climbed to the row of stones on the wall and unfurled the Israeli flag at the heights of the Kosel. I met that person. His commander promised him a reward for his deed and asked him to state his request. "The greatest honor for me is to send an army to bring our Rebbe, our Tzvi Yehuda Kook, the Rosh Yeshiva Merkaz Rav here." The officer also told us that Rav Gorin had been among the first to reach the Kosel, and in the face of fire from Arab snipers who continued to shoot, he clutched a Torah skull and pulled the shofar, etc. Many of our boys were wounded in the charge, but Baruch Hashem, all the gates are now open. Another student, a rabbi in the army, rushed up to the Kosel and told me he had received permission from the army command to daven mincha at the wall. It was the first national prayer at the Kosel after 1,900-year separation. A prayer which was utter cleavage to Hashem. Every eye was filled with tears. Soldiers prostrated themselves on the ground in front of the Kosel. Others waged their fingers between the stones of the wall. Everyone chanted Tehillim, Shir Malos, and so on. It was like those who dream Hayinu Kachomim. Before we left the liberated city, I was interviewed by radio and television reporters from Israel and from outside the land. They wanted to know my opinion on what had transpired. "Behold," I said, "we announce to all of Israel, to all of the world, that by divine command we have returned to our home, to our holy city. From this day forth, we shall never budge from here. We have come home." This is from the teachings of Tzvi Yehuda Kook. If you read the book, The Dreamers, about the Soviet soldiers who were there, one of the people who was there recorded, I don't know if this is in that book or not, recorded the following. Nobody knew, a lot of people didn't know who these two Rabbanim were. They were soldiers. This was a minute ago, a battlefield. Guns were firing and so on. And bullets were... And so all of a sudden, you have these two old rabbis, you know, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook and Rav David Cohen, walking up to the Kosel HaMaravi, and some of the soldiers were bewildered and concluded that it must be that this is Eliyahu HaNavi and the Mashiach. Because who in the world else would be here at this time? It made no sense. Who else would be here dressed like that at this time? It's got to be Eliyahu HaNavi and the Mashiach. They're going to announce that the Mashiach has arrived. That was the feeling. That again, not necessarily religious soldiers, but that was the feeling that they had. And really, after it's Rabbi Yehuda and the Nazi, but they felt that this was something which was just, you know, remarkable. And so as we look at an overview of the history of Yerushalayim, how many times they said at the outlet, the city was conquered by this one and that one, and fights and civil wars, and it was an important city, it was a non-important city, it was populated, it was not populated, and Jews couldn't live there, and Jews could live there, all of that, it's come today to a conclusion, as Rabbi Yehuda said, and there's something else I would have read, but we'll leave it for another time, and I'll conclude again with his word. "Behold," I said, "we announce to all of Israel and to all of the world that by divine command we have returned to our home, to our holy city. From this day forth we shall never budge from here. We have come home." That's the nechama of Kolomis Abba Yerushalayim. Zoha v'ro b'vinyana. May it happen. It's full b'vinyana. May it happen.